This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, so it's 12:58. We'll get started at just a few minutes after 1 o'clock. So if anyone's dialing in, please just go ahead and stand by, and we'll get started in a few minutes. Rebecca, did you get my last email?
The tweaks to the press release?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
Terrific.
Unfortunately, my ED just made some tweaks.
Okay.
And I don't think that there's anything that actually matters a lot.
Okay.
Actually, at all.
All right. So, I don't know if your executive director is getting on the line, but it's 12:59, and we'll start in just a couple of minutes. So if people are dialing in, please, we are going to get started in just a few minutes, so please stand by for the presentation. Thank you. Okay, it's 1 o'clock. If you're just dialing into the call, we're going to start in just a few minutes. So please know that you're all the callers in are on mute, and we'd like you to leave your lines on mute until it's time for the Q&A, and we'll get started in just a few minutes. Hi, if you've just dialed in, we'll be starting the presentation in just a few minutes. It's 1:01 p.m. We'll be starting the presentation in just a few minutes. We're giving others an opportunity to dial in. Thank you. Hello, if you've just dialed into the call, we'll be getting started in just a few minutes. As you heard when you dialed in, you're on mute. So if you wouldn't mind leaving your line on mute until the Q&A section, that would be great. And we'll be getting started in just a couple of minutes. We're just giving people an opportunity to dial in. Thank you. Hi, if you're just joining us, we're going to start the call in about 2 minutes. We're just giving people an opportunity to dial in, so please just stand by. Thank you. joining us. We're going to start the call in just about a minute. We're just giving other people a chance to dial in. So we will start momentarily. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining our call. It's about 5 minutes after the hour, so we're going to go ahead and get started. I just want to let everybody know they're in listen-only mode currently, and you'll be able to unmute your line by hitting *6 when we start the Q&A section of the call. But if you don't mind leaving your line muted for now, that'll minimize the background noise. And now I'd like to turn it over to Michelle Wasland of the Immigration Policy Center. Michelle?
Great. Thanks, Wendy. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. I am Michelle Wasland. I'm the Senior Policy Analyst at the Immigration Policy Center in Washington, D.C. IPC is a nonpartisan organization that provides policymakers, the media, and the general public with accurate information about the role of immigrants and immigration policy in U.S. society. This call is being recorded, and the recording will be put on our website later today, so just wanted you all to be aware that this was being recorded. Thank you for joining today's call on immigration, biometrics, and databases. IPC is very happy to be partnering with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and today we're co-releasing a paper entitled From Fingerprints to DNA, Biometric Data Collection in U.S. Immigrant Communities and Beyond. And this paper, as well as an executive summary and a fact sheet, are all available on our website, which is immigrationpolicy.org, and they are also available on EFF.org. So why are we issuing this paper and doing this call today? These days, we hear a lot about biometrics. We hear about DNA, fingerprints, retina scans. We all have watched CSI and seen the wonders of biometrics on that show. In the immigration world, we're definitely seeing an increase in the collection of personal information and biometrics, like fingerprints. And we're also seeing many more large databases that store all of this information. So, for example, the Secure Communities program has received a lot of attention, and this program is based on taking the fingerprints of people that are booked into jails and matching them to fingerprints that are contained in large immigration databases. And these immigration databases already contain fingerprint information from everyone who's come into contact with the immigration system. So people who are crossing the border, people applying for immigration benefits, people naturalizing and becoming U.S. citizens, people who have applied for refugee status, people who have been in immigration detention. These fingerprints are stored, and these types of databases are growing and becoming increasingly connected to other government databases. We're also seeing the government begin to collect other biometrics, like DNA. One of our speakers is going to tell you about a proposal to collect DNA from all people detained by the federal government, regardless of whether they've been convicted of a crime. Those of us in the immigration world, again, know that tens of thousands of non-citizens are detained by the U.S. every day, are held in detention every day. So what does it mean to collect DNA from all of them? And what happens to that information? We've also heard many proposals over the years to create biometric national ID cards as a way to separate those who are legally present to live and work in the U.S. from those who are not. We have the E-Verify system, which is an electronic employment verification system that allows employers to verify whether their employees are authorized to work in the U.S. by checking workers' documents against government databases. Some have suggested taking this a step further and creating a biometric ID card so that employers could be sure that the person working for them is really the person in the database and is really authorized to work. But would a biometric ID really work? Would it resolve the accuracy problems that exist in the current E-Verify system? Would this only apply to non-citizens? And how would it affect U.S. citizens? these are the types of questions we need to be asking now about biometrics and databases because these are becoming more and more prevalent in immigration enforcement. So to help us answer these questions, we have two excellent speakers. Let me introduce our speakers. First, we'll have Jennifer Lynch, who's a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and works on open government transparency and privacy issues. In addition to government transparency, Jennifer has written and spoken frequently on government surveillance programs, intelligent community misconduct, and biometrics collection. Jennifer wrote, she's the author of the paper that IPC and EFF are releasing today. So she's going to give you an overview of biometrics, how they're collected, how they're stored, and what this means for immigrants, U.S. citizens, and the impact on privacy. And then our other speaker today will be Jonathan Weinberg. John is a professor of law at Wayne State University, and he's published articles on topics including internet and high technology law, privacy law, and immigration law. He is the co-author of another report called Hard to Believe, The High Cost of a Biometric Identity Card. This report was released in February by the Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy of the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. John will discuss the concept of a national biometric ID card. What does it mean? What would it involve? How much does it cost? And what are the potential problems? So each speaker is going to give a short presentation, and then after they have spoken, we'll open up the lines for questions. Again, you'll receive instructions on how to unmute yourself so that you can ask a question. Just another reminder that the materials, the report that's being released today is available at immigrationpolicy.org and EFF.org. And one more reminder that this call is being recorded for public use and it will be made available on our website later today. So with that, I will turn it over to our first speaker, Jennifer Lynch.
Thanks, Michelle. So thanks to everybody who's on the call right now. I was really excited to work with the Immigration Policy Center to produce the white paper on the current state of biometrics collection in the United States. I think it's a really big and important issue for those of us who work in the privacy and technology world and also for those other folks who work in immigration. We're really seeing an intersection of these two areas right now. So the white paper provides an overview of several different types of biometrics, from fingerprints to facial recognition to DNA. And it includes some technical information on how biometrics work to identify someone. It then discusses some of the problems with the increased biometrics collection in the United States, both in the immigration context and beyond. On the call today, I'm going to talk a little bit about what biometrics are and then about some recent developments at the intersection of biometrics and immigration. And as Michelle mentioned, we'll have time later for questions, but I'd also refer you to the entire paper, which is on both IPC and EFF's websites. So biometrics are unique markers that identify an individual or verify a person's identity. They include everything from the most common marker, such as a fingerprint, to the most revealing, DNA. And they also include things that once seemed like science fiction, everything from iris prints, facial images, and even how an individual walks or a person's voice or the unique patterns of their keystrokes on a computer. All of these are either in development or currently used as biometrics today. Currently, the federal government and all of the states collect fingerprints and DNA for most people who have interactions with the criminal justice system, including immigrants. More and more states are also now collecting facial recognition photographs and palm and iris prints and sharing this data with the federal government through several large FBI and DHS databases. And all of this data is shared across the federal government as well through refugee and asylum programs, counterterrorism programs, and through secure communities. Two of the biggest developments in biometrics in the last few years that have really affected immigrant communities are the increased use of handheld devices to collect fingerprints and other biometrics, and then the recent news that under Department of Justice regulations, DHS, ICE, and other components are required to collect DNA from almost any non-U.S. person they detain. These are non-citizens, even if that detention has nothing to do with a criminal violation. And these two developments have the potential to exponentially increase the amount of data the government has on everyone in the United States. So in the first example, the handheld devices, we know that most major and many smaller police departments have portable handheld devices, some of which connect to an iPhone or BlackBerry, and these allow them to collect biometrics in the field. While these tools are convenient for law enforcement, they can increase racial profiling and the targeting of immigrant communities. And this is what appears to be happening in Los Angeles right now. We've heard from some of our friends at ENDLON, the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, and CHRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, that LAPD officers have been going up to day laborers on street corners and telling them to submit to portable fingerprint scans. These day laborers are not suspected of any criminal activity that we know of. LAPD just seems to be using the devices to harass them and just to collect fingerprints. While most of us will be really suspect if a police officer randomly asked us to submit to a fingerprint scan on the street, when you feel like you have little voice in society and you lack power to challenge authority, I think harassment like this is a big issue. The second example, the expansion of DNA collection from people with no contact with the criminal justice system, we just learned of recently in a response to one of EFF's Freedom of Information Act requests. We asked ICE for records on what they were doing to implement Department of Justice regulations that require DHS and its entities underneath it to collect DNA from almost any non-U.S. person the agency is detained. We learned that the program could be broader than anything we would have suspected because ICE and DHS may be collecting DNA from juveniles as young as 14 and are considering collecting DNA from kids even younger than that. DHS itself estimates that this program could affect about 1 million people a year. The expansion of DNA collection is a real issue because DNA has the potential to reveal so much information about you, everything from who you are to your potential for disease to behavioral characteristics and possibly even sexual orientation. It also reveals who you're related to, so even if your personal DNA isn't in a database, if one of your relatives' DNA is, you could be identified. So I look forward to hearing your questions. Thanks for being on the call.
Great. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Now I'll turn it over to Jonathan Weinberg.
Okay. Thanks so much. I want to follow up by talking to you guys a little bit about a particular use of biometric that's been proposed in the immigration context, and that's the use of biometric identifiers in government-issued ID cards that migrants. In fact, that all U.S. workers would have to provide in order to be eligible to work in this country. And the backstory is this. Many of you may already know it. Back in 1986, Congress enacts comprehensive immigration reform with the goal of solving the immigration problem once and for all, included new provisions to legalize a lot of the people who are already here, and provisions to make it illegal for employers to hire any new unauthorized migrants. And the idea was that the folks who entered illegally wouldn't be able to get jobs, then they'd have no incentive to come here in the first place. As you all know, it didn't work out that way. Employers today hire unauthorized migrants by the millions. Where there are jobs, people seem to find them, notwithstanding the provisions of the 1986 law. Well, since shortly after 86, you know, some people have said that, gee, the law would work better if only migrants were required to present secure, unforgeable ID before starting a job, proving that they were legally entitled to work in the U.S. In that way, at least this is how the thought went, there'd be fewer instances of unauthorized migrants presenting fake IDs and employers winking at the fake IDs and the law being evaded. So, you know, we've had a lot of proposals for what's sometimes referred to as a hardened Social Security card. And the idea here is that the card would be hard to counterfeit, so people couldn't just easily go on and get a fake one, and it would carry digitally encoded biometric information, so a person wouldn't be able to just borrow or steal somebody else's card. Now, when you think about it, this is a pretty big project, because first of all, the card's going to need multiple levels of security. It would need to be hard to forge, hard to tamper with, hardened against unauthorized attempts to pull out the data for identity theft purposes. Every U.S. employer would need to have or have access to equipment to read the data encoded on the cards. Now, people's immigration and work status changes over time, so the employer hardware would have to connect to a central national database that said whether the person was authorized to work. And most importantly, I guess, you know, it's not just immigrants and non-citizens who'd have to carry the cards. Every U.S. worker would have to have one, because otherwise, you know, a migrant could just masquerade as a U.S. citizen and bypass this all hardened card infrastructure we've just put in place. So we're talking about somewhere north of 150 million U.S. workers who would need to go to some government office to get their fingerprints or hand scans taken, so that their biometric information would be encoded on an ID card that they need to present to prove their eligibility to work. Okay. The folks on this call who aren't familiar with the stuff I'm describing will figure that I'm scaremongering, that what I'm saying is crazy, that no one would really propose what I've just described. But in fact, I'm describing a real plan put forth as recently as a couple of years ago by folks including the Senate Majority Leader. People are serious about this. And so Michael Frumkin and I wrote a paper a few months ago. It's available on the Berkeley Warren Institute website, explaining why we think this would be a really bad idea. This isn't covered in the joint EFF-IPC paper that's released today. So if you want to know more about this, you'll have to go read ours. It's called Hard to Believe, the High Cost of a Biometric Identity Card. And you can find it by Googling Berkeley Biometric ID Report. But I'll summarize very briefly what we say there. Number one, this plan would be really, really costly. I mean, supporters have thrown around numbers like $10 billion for startup costs. Near as we can tell, a conservative estimate of startup costs would be close to $40 billion. And then there'd be no additional recurring costs in the neighborhood of $3 billion a year. And that includes not only direct costs to governments, but also costs imposed on employers, you know, also productivity losses imposed on the economy. And, you know, that's a conservative estimate. Actual losses might be significantly higher. Number two, it wouldn't work. It would carry over bad data in existing databases about who is and isn't entitled to work in the U.S. It'd be plagued by error in collecting 150 million workers' biometric information. And people would still be able to create fraudulent IDs. Number three, it would end up hurting the most vulnerable, poor, sick, chronically unemployed, folks who are least likely to have their papers in order, the homeless, casual labor hires, basically amount to a work tax hitting hardest the folks in low-wage, high-turnover jobs. Number four, it would encourage identity theft when, and I say when, not if, the cards and databases were hacked. And number five, you know, once we've all had our biometrics encoded on a new national ID card, the card will almost certainly end up being used for a broader range of purposes. Because, you know, that's just how government mission creep works. You know, that fine-grained degree of identification and control is going to be just too valuable to leave focused on immigration alone. Thank you. That's my spiel.
Thank you so much, John. Now, in a couple of seconds, we're going to take your questions for our speakers. This is a reminder that you're all muted currently, so to ask a question, you hit star six to unmute yourself, and we'll moderate this to make sure that two of you aren't trying to ask a question at the same time. And please keep your questions brief. And also, please make sure that you do ask a question. So as you're preparing your questions and preparing to hit star six, I just wanted to start out with a quick question for Jennifer. So Jennifer, as I understand this, if the police are in a crime scene, for example, and they find a fingerprint, they could take that fingerprint and run it through all of these different government databases. And that fingerprint could match my fingerprint if I'd ever been printed by the federal government, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering, what are the concerns involved with this? How accurate are biometrics? Are those fingerprint matches always 100%, you know, accurate? Because if not, that could be a huge concern for all of us.
Yeah, so there's a lot of problems with biometrics and accuracy, and especially when you're talking about a situation that you just proposed where you're taking an unknown fingerprint, we don't know whose fingerprint it is, and trying to match it against all of the fingerprints in a database. And that's sort of the most extreme example, especially when you're talking about a database like the FBI's database where you have 100 million fingerprints in the database. And there are a lot of inaccuracies in the system, even in a fingerprint system where the Department of Justice has been collecting fingerprints for over 100 years, so their records are that old. And I think John, in his paper, has a lot of information, really great information on the problems with biometrics collection and inaccuracies. The other thing that we're seeing as the federal government starts collecting more and more different types of biometrics is that a lot of the biometrics are less reliable than others. So, for example, facial recognition, which the federal government and the states are really excited about these days, has a high rate of inaccuracies. It's very dependent on different lighting and different age, how your hair looks in one picture to the next, and there's a pretty high rate of error in the facial recognition databases. So there are a lot of errors that come up.
Great, thanks. And John, even when you're matching, you know, my fingerprint to my fingerprint in the database, there's also still a possibility of error there, correct?
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I mean, there are two sorts of errors we have to worry about. And the first is a fingerprint matching someone that shouldn't, and you just discussed that. The second is a fingerprint not matching someone whom it should, either because it's entirely unreadable or it's not unreadable, but it just doesn't come up as a match. And if we're talking fingerprints, when the census last time around fingerprinted all its census workers, now, even after extensive training, they had about 5% bad prints. Better technology can bring that down. But even with the best technology, it seems hard to imagine that we're going to get a rate of unreadable prints or otherwise bad matches lower than 1% to 2%. Now, so that means for my immediate concern that if we have the sort of employment ID plan I described, and you fingerprint 150 million American workers, more than a million of those people, maybe a lot more, but at least more than a million of them, aren't going to match the fingerprints they took.
Mm-hmm. And that means they could be fired from their job because they wouldn't be verified.
Well, at least it means that when they're trying to get a new job, they wouldn't be able to get it until they worked through whatever appeals process the government had put in place to address those problems.
Great. Thanks so much. Do we have any questions? Please identify yourself and ask a question.
Yes, this is Elena Shore from New America Media.
Hi, Elena.
Hi. I just have a basic question about if you can just clarify which of these are already in effect and which are proposals that have not yet gone into effect.
Sure. So I can take the answer to that. So in the paper that IPC and EFF are releasing today, we talk a lot pretty specifically about the proposals that are currently going on. So currently the federal government and most of the states, well, all of the states are collecting DNA and fingerprints from people who have some sort of interaction with the criminal justice system. We have several large federal and state databases that collect DNA and fingerprints. They're currently separate from each other. The federal government has also recently developed or expanded its fingerprint database, and the new name of that is called the Next Generation Identification, and they are currently including palm prints in that database, and they've just recently started a pilot program to accept facial recognition-ready photographs. So those are currently going on. There are a number of programs within the federal government that allow the exchange of data. Secure Communities is the most well-known amongst people who are involved in immigrant activism. And that program requires the states that collect fingerprints from anybody who interacts with the criminal justice system to send those fingerprints to FBI, and then FBI shares them with the DHS database, and that allows ICE to put a detainer on the person who has been arrested. So before the person is convicted of any crime, they have a detainer put on them and ICE can come and pick them up. So those programs are currently going on. The BELIEVE program is currently just in its proposal state. But it's, you know, the federal government has proposed using some form of biometrics identification card for a number of years now. So I think we think that it's going to be on the horizon soon.
Well, and in fact, the E-Verify system does already have a biometric aspect in that there's the photo tool, right? So
yeah, they're not currently using facial recognition, though. So it's a photograph, but it's just a visual match. So there's a photograph in the database, in the E-Verify database, and what the E-Verify program requires an employer to do is to look at the document that the person provides, the prospective employee provides. So let's say that person brings in their passport or their driver's license. It would be a passport, actually, because we're talking about a federal database. And so then the employer visually looks at the picture that's in the E-Verify system and says, does this picture match the picture that's on the passport in front of me or the other identification card? So currently it's not a biometric in the sense that we're talking about because it's not a facial recognition program. The computer is not doing the matching. The employer is doing the visual match.
Great. Thanks for that clarification, and thanks for the question.
I had a question.
Oh, yes, please. Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, Adam Carroll with the Muslim American Civil Liberties Coalition. Question about how the total system works and the standards of implementation or standards of suspicion. You've got the biometrics. You've got surveillance cameras in our cities everywhere. You've got the handheld devices and so forth and so on. So as far as whether it's ICE or the Feds or the PD or whatever law enforcement, what level of suspicion is necessary for them to access your biometric data?
To access it when it's already in the database or to collect it, say, if you're on the street or in the police department?
Well, you know, say protesters. They've been photographed and their picture is apparently in the system. Does that mean that, therefore, wherever they go, the CompStat or other systems will call up their face and say, oh, the GPS says those people are on 37th Street? I mean, how far does that go?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and there's a few different parts to it. So the first part, if we're talking about a protest situation where, let's say the police take a bunch of photographs or maybe there's some security camera photographs and whether those pictures can go into a database. I think right now there isn't a lot of law on this. If we're talking about a protest where somebody's in a public place, so they're maybe protesting in downtown Washington, D.C. or downtown San Francisco, I think most police departments and the way that the courts are currently looking at this, those people are in a public place and they have a lower expectation of privacy, if any expectation of privacy, in their image. And so there is the potential for that photograph to end up in, for example, the Next Generation Identification FBI database, and then to be searched anytime a photograph is uploaded and checked against the database in the future. Now, I will say that at this point, the facial recognition technology is not advanced enough to accurately identify somebody. But it's a real issue in the future, I think, as the technology improves, because those pictures will already be in the database. And currently, police departments and the FBI don't have any specific rules or standards in place really on when those pictures get uploaded to a database. In the past, the database has only allowed mugshots, so it hasn't been so much of an issue because those are taken at the police department. But as the Next Generation Identification database expands, it will allow security camera photos and just any type of photo to be uploaded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Just 2 points to that, I think. The first is that there are clearly, something Jennifer wasn't speaking to, there are clearly constitutional limitations on collection of at least some biometric information. The notion of the police, you know, walking up to somebody on the street and saying, without reasonable suspicion of a crime being committed, give me your fingerprints, you know, is seriously legally and constitutionally problematic, although that doesn't seem to have stopped the LAPD. The second is that there's at least room for an argument that there are constitutional limitations on the government taking advantage of even information that's available to the public if they're doing so to construct in a context where they can construct a massive surveillance profile. Now, this is an issue that the Supreme Court has left open in a recent case. They haven't said yes to it, but they also haven't said no.
Thanks for that clarification, John. Do we have another question?
I have a question.
Okay, please identify yourself.
Sure. My name is Natalia Martins. I'm with the German Marshall Fund. And my question is regarding an exit system for visa overstayers and whether biometrics are being used to see who is overstaying their visas or to, you know, have a system of tracking who's actually leaving the country and who's overstaying their visas.
That's a really great question. Jennifer, do you want to take that?
I can't. Well, so my caveat is that I don't know so much about the visa program, but I can tell you that DHS is collecting fingerprints and photographs from people who cross the borders who are non-U.S. citizens. And I believe that a photograph is and fingerprints are also taken for any visa application. So that information is currently in DHS's database. DHS has recently signed a large contract with a private company to build out its own facial recognition database. So there's definitely a possibility of that happening in the future. Whether it's going on now or not, I don't know.
Congress and DHS have wanted for a long time, as you may know, to get much more fine-grained information collection at the visa exit stage. But they've really been stymied in putting a workable plan in place, and I'm not sure just how far they've gotten at this point.
That's right. The entry system is certainly in place and biometrics are being taken. The exit system has not been fully implemented yet.
Thank you.
Yep. Do we have another question? Any more questions? Hit star 6 to unmute yourself.
Yeah, this is Carl Berquist with CHRLA in Los Angeles. I have a question regarding, it touches on the last point about entry-exit. There are other ways that DHS collects biometrics, for example, when you apply for immigration benefits, whether it's permanent residency or even when you naturalize. And I'm curious about how that biometrics is used and also about whether that is expunged at any point. Once you become a citizen, for example?
I don't believe that it's expunged. I can't remember the exact timeline for DHS's data. Hi, Carl, by the way. Carl helped out with some great stories about what was going on in L.A. with the day laborers, so I wanted to thank you for that. I know that DHS collects and keeps records for at least 75 years. I don't believe that the data is expunged once you become a citizen. I believe that it stays in the database. All DHS's databases are linked through IDENT. That's the main DHS biometrics database that has over 100 million fingerprints in it. And so whether you're interacting with USCIS or ICE or DHS, the umbrella entity, the umbrella agency, all of the biometrics collection goes into IDENT.
Yeah, and it's certainly the case, this is Michelle, that if you're booked into jail and your fingerprints are taken and your fingerprints are run through secure communities against those immigration databases, if you are a naturalized U.S. citizen, there can very well be a match, a secure communities hit, because there is a match between your fingerprints and the fingerprints in the database. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that ICE can take enforcement action against you, or at least they shouldn't, although we know that that does happen sometimes because there are these database hits with U.S. citizens. John, did you have anything to add to that conversation?
I think we're good. I mean, the bigger problem is, as sometimes happens, a U.S. citizen can be arrested, and by virtue of database error, he gets a hit as something other than a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
And that's where the problems really pile up.
That's a good point. Thanks for that question. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Corey Lazar from the Office of Legal Access Programs in the Executive Office for Immigration Review. And I was just wondering, do you know how they're going about collecting DNA, like how police officers or whoever is collecting the DNA?
Yeah, they're doing it through a cheek swab. So it's very rare to collect DNA through a blood draw anymore. It's generally the FBI produces these kits, and they have a swab, and you know, and an officer, whether that's an ICE officer or LAPD or the federal government officer, takes a swab off of a person's inner cheek, and then that's processed through the FBI's systems, and the sample is stored, and the profile, which is extracted from the sample, is put into the FBI's CODIS database. Go ahead.
Jennifer, can you explain that a little bit more about how the fingerprints and the DNA or any other biometrics are translated into some type of digital format, and that's the information that's stored?
Yeah, sure. So it used to be that when anybody collected fingerprints, you retained the image of the fingerprint. So, you know, it's what you think of when you see a fingerprint, or when you think of the word fingerprint, you see a picture of the different lines on the finger. And now what's going on is that fingerprint is turned into, or the, any kind of biometric is turned into an algorithm, and the algorithm is stored. So if another fingerprint is being checked against the first fingerprint, they're being checked algorithm to algorithm. So it's really a mathematical check instead of a visual check. And the same thing is going on with DNA collection. So a DNA sample is collected. That's, you know, the skin, a little bit of the skin from the inner cheek, some of the saliva, and then that sample is processed, and a few specific markers are withdrawn from the sample and turned into the same kind of an algorithm and entered into a computer. So we're not talking about every time a DNA sample is collected, let's say, from a crime scene, that it has to be processed over and over and over again. It's processed once and then put into the database. And there are some good things and bad things about that. Some good things are that the systems are more accurate. You're not talking about a fingerprint expert looking at one fingerprint, trying to determine if it matches another fingerprint. So a computer can be more accurate in that kind of a system. The other advantage to using an algorithm is that you can put in distinct, it's called a hash, and that's a sort of a distinct kind of mathematical piece that can be, that marks the biometric as belonging to a certain database. And if the biometric gets stolen, you can change the hash in the database so that the biometric can't be used again, so it can't be used for identity theft. It's a little bit complicated, and I go into it in a little bit more detail in the paper. But it's an advantage of using a mathematical-based system rather than a visual-based system.
Thanks so much. Do we have any other questions on the line? Any more questions going on?
I guess I had one more about FOIL requests or FOIA requests. I mean, to get more information, especially about how this information is being used by law enforcement. You know, again, in New York City here, you know, we've got the NYPD surveillance scandal, and policies haven't changed. It's a very broad brush that we see of suspicion. So, you know, can these tools be used for broader community surveillance rather than specific cases?
How are you thinking?
Whoever asked the question, are you still there? Can you hit star six?
Sorry, I put myself on mute. Sorry. It's Adam Carroll.
And so I just was just wanted a little bit more information about your question. You were asking about broader community surveillance.
Yes.
So,
broader meaning, you know, keeping tabs of all the mosques or all the student groups in a city, for example. Can the collection of both DNA and biometric information lawfully be used as a tool in that sort of that scale of collection of data at this point? Does the law allow it?
Well, so I think there are two different questions. One is it possible? And I think at this point it would be prohibitively expensive. There are tools that are in development to sniff up, you know, all the DNA that's in the New York subway, in a New York subway stop, and try and identify who's in the stop. And so people are currently working on that kind of technology, and at some point in the future that will be possible. And in that kind of a situation, you could potentially identify everybody who's in a given area, because we all shed DNA wherever we go. We can't do anything about that. But that's prohibitively expensive at this point. Now, your second question about whether it's legally possible, I think, is a really an open question. The case that John mentioned earlier, the U.S. versus Jones case that the Supreme Court decided earlier this spring or in the late winter, dealt with whether police can put a GPS tracking device on a car and follow that car for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for a month without having to get a warrant first. And all nine justices on the court had strong issues with that and said that that was not acceptable for one reason or another. Now, the majority in the case decided it a little bit on a technicality of the device being put on the car, but I think that the opinion in the case shows that the justices are really wary with that kind of constant surveillance without a warrant. And I talk about this a little bit in the paper about how this case, I think, could be applied to biometrics collection, and it sounds like John thinks that as well. I think that there's a, you know, as we get to a point where we're talking about more the potential for constant government surveillance, this is going to be a bigger and bigger issue, and the courts are going to have to address this.
Thank you. Are there?
Thank you. That was helpful. Thanks.
Any other questions for either of our speakers? Okay. Well, thank you all again. Much thanks to our two wonderful speakers, and thank you to everybody who joined us today on this call. If you have any more questions after you hang up, or if you want to get in touch with our speakers, you can call Wendy Sefsaf, our communications manager. She's at 202-507-7524, and she can put you in touch with the speakers. Otherwise, the paper is up at immigrationpolicy.org or EFF.org, and we hope that you will read it and enjoy it and find it useful. So thank you again, everybody. Bye-bye. Bye.